From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, we meet Cheryl Milnes, the opera star from the Midwest, who nevertheless earned the nickname the King of the Italian Baritones. Also today, I speak with Jonathan Tunick, who has orchestrated most of Stephen Sondheim's Broadway shows, including the current hit Into the Woods. And we have reviews of The Trial of Bernard Goetz, airing this week on public television's American Playhouse, and of a new jazz reissue featuring tenor saxophonist Don Byas. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Cheryl Milnes is one of the world's leading operatic baritones. Since 1965, he's sung with the Metropolitan Opera. While praising his strong voice, critics have also taken note of his rugged good looks. Milnes has been called the King of the Italian Baritones, even though his background is American heartland, having grown up on a dairy farm in Downers Grove, Illinois. He earned the nickname for his interpretations of Verdi and Puccini. When we spoke, he was preparing to sing Puccini's Tosca at the Met. Before we hear from Cheryl Milnes, let's listen to an excerpt of the Te Deum from Tosca. Milnes sings the role of Scarpia, the evil chief of police. Zubin Mehta conducts the new Philharmonia Orchestra. I asked Cheryl Milnes how he prepares to do a role he's already performed many times before, like Scarpia in Tosca.
Well, to a certain degree, you have to wait until you work with your colleagues, because a lot of what you do is determined by the reaction of your colleagues, and not so much the tenor Cavaradossi in this case, because Scarpia's relationship to him is very clear. They are on opposite sides of the political fence in 1800 Rome. But how the Tosca reacts determines very much what the Scarpia does. Also, the sound of your voice and your physical appearance sets up certain elements that you can't change. Your voice sounds as your voice sounds, and so Scarpia has to have that voice. You can't use somebody else's voice or change the color enormously.
You grew up on a dairy farm in Downers Grove, Illinois. Is a farm background uncommon in the opera world?
I suppose, yeah. Milking cows and making hay and all those down and dirty things is not the normal. opera singer background, although I guess the work ethic part is serves you well throughout your life.
How were you exposed to opera?
Well, very atypical, untypical farm life. My mother was a piano teacher, church choir director. So music was, in fact, a part of our family everyday life. And I was brought up in church music. All the oratorios, Bach cantatas and hymns and so forth. Opera was kind of a late listening experience, although we did listen on Saturday afternoons to the Met broadcasts when we were near a radio. So I suppose in hearing, opera wasn't so unusual, but to see it or ever certainly ever think about singing opera as a career, that was very far from my thoughts. But music as a part of my life was very normal.
Didn't you study about 6 or 7 different instruments plus voice when you were growing up?
Violin, piano, and in high school I learned to play jazz bass and played in dance bands all through high school and college.
Yeah, so all of that, and then you decided to go to pre-med school. I can't figure that out.
Well, that was 1 year's worth. I suppose to make a fairly complicated story somewhat simpler, because music had always been a part of my life, I thought of it more as an avocation rather than a vocation. And early on, when I was young, my uncle, my mother's brother, died of appendicitis. It was early enough. They had just discovered penicillin, but it was early enough so that it was not readily available. And he died needlessly in my mind when I found out about it after the fact. And somehow, as a little kid makes certain decisions, I thought that was such a terrible thing that my uncle would die of a disease that, when I found out about it, was no longer necessary. Penicillin was then available. That I somehow thought I wanted to be a doctor. You know, this is grade school time, junior high. I wanted to be a doctor, and that just kind of stayed with me. So I took heavy science curriculum in high school and then spent a year in pre-med. But what happened in pre-med, it's a very tough science, math, chemistry set of courses, and I had no time for music that 1 year. And when it was taken away from me, then I realized how important it was to me.
I think it's maybe very important to get away from music for a while so that you feel that you're making the decision to have your life be that musical as opposed to the decision having been preordained and you have no way out.
Yeah, there's something to that. Certainly, that year away, I felt a frustration internally because even going to choir rehearsal Thursday night and singing services Sunday morning was almost out. And I didn't play violin in a symphony that I had been playing for several years. Dance jobs, there just wasn't time. The homework load was too great. Well, during that year, at some point, I realized what frustration, this kind of void inside of me was. And it was the fact that I was being deprived of that which I loved more than the medicine, and that was music.
Baritone Cheryl Milnes is my guest. You got your start touring with Boris Goldovsky's opera company. Did that enable you to establish yourself in America without having to go to Europe first?
Well, certainly. I don't know that I would use the word establish. That probably took a little more time, city opera years and early years at the Met to really establish. But certainly the Goldovsky experience allowed me to improve, allowed me to become good enough in America to go on to a big career. 300 performances over 100,000 miles, over a dozen different roles all over this country. That's the kind of experience that people will often go to Germany to get, one of the small German houses.
Now, that company used to, the way I understand it, travel by bus across the country and perform in many places that didn't have resident opera companies.
Well, in fact, they performed everywhere that didn't. And in the 60s, which we're talking about, there were far fewer regional companies than exist now. Much has happened in the last couple of decades. And all the operas were in English, and no super titles, whatever. We had to Boris beat up on us if our diction wasn't good enough. And, well, Tosca was one of those that I sang in English the first time.
Was that good experience, singing in English first and not having to worry about mastering a new language as you're getting your voice in shape?
Oh, absolutely. From two points of view, I think. Vocal technique, what you were saying, you don't have to add the other problem of the language mastery, but also specific and exact stage movements, because you knew what you were saying. You didn't have to think of a translation because it was your language. You did movements, you did gestures, you did emotional reactions to your colleagues' words at precisely the right time because you understood every nuance, past tense, future tense, subjective, and so forth. Then when you, in a sense, graduated to the original language, graduated in the sense of certainly the contours, the flow of it as the composer originally intended is better. There is a gain and a loss. There is a gain of clarity in English when the singers make good diction. But there is a loss of the flow because the composers wrote melodic lines and sweep to go with a certain set of sounds. But when you went to the original language, then what you did on stage was far more specific. You didn't just gesture sometime in these two or three measures. You were precise, and the punch, the sharp edges of the character stayed.
Do you ever wish you could sing more in English when you do foreign operas?
Well, there's also the problem of the audience. Now I don't sing as often for the uninitiated. For the initiated, mm-hmm. The original language has clarity and sharp edges, as I said before, and they're used to those sounds, the international audiences, mm-hmm. the major houses around the world. Sometimes, for instance, Hamlet, which I have been doing in the last several years, I've done that both in French and in English. Well, because Hamlet, as the opera in French, is in fact a translation from Shakespeare's English, doing it in English is in a way the more original. Also, it's a great play, as we know, and the audience can follow it much more clearly. When I did the Hamlet in English, it felt as though I was doing a Shakespearean play, whereas in French, it's grand French opera that is somewhat related to Shakespeare.
I'd like to get back for a moment to your early touring with the Boris Goldovsky Company. You went to a lot of places that many singers might have considered the sticks because it wasn't New York. I think from your background, you wouldn't have condescended to the places and the audiences you were going to because you weren't a native New Yorker yourself. You were from a farm background.
Yes, I didn't consider any of the places we sang at all irregular or... first of all, it was what the tour schedule said. we were scheduled to sing, and he would do as many as six a week, and there was a double cast. So you sang every other performance, whether it was every other day or every third, fourth day, depended on the schedule. Also, there is an odd thing. When you are in a set, let's say a Tosca set, when you're actually doing singing, playing Scarpia in the performance, you could be anywhere in the world because the set is the same set in any city. When you are in the hotel, when you're walking around the town, whatever, then it has its own characteristics. But when you are on stage, it almost doesn't matter, if you understand what I mean. It almost doesn't matter where you are. Even now in the big leagues, you could be in London or Paris or Vienna or Scala, Milano. If it was a production that you knew, when you're in the set, you could be in any of those cities and it really wouldn't matter.
I want to talk with you more about your life, but we're going to take a short break first. My guest is baritone Cheryl Milnes. We'll talk some more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Baritone Cheryl Milnes is my guest. Before we talk some more, let's listen to an excerpt of him singing the Eddie II from Verdi's Un ballo in Mascara. Cheryl Milnes, you sing a lot of Verdi. Did he write especially well for baritones?
Yes. Verdi, in fact, treated the baritone voice in a special way, differently than the bel canto composers before him, and certainly Mozart or Bach, Handel, the Baroque composers. He wrote a higher tessitura line, higher lying line, and a fatter orchestration underneath it. And he, in a sense, he forced baritones of the time and subsequent generations to almost find a new technique, a new way to sustain the high notes. And I suppose over a period of time that the phrase Verdi baritone developed. You have to be able to sit with Fs, F-sharps, Gs, A-flats, sometimes A-naturals.
What's the difference between the operatic life of a tenor and a baritone?
Oh, we're normal. Everyone knows that.
No, but do you ever feel that...
Are you listening, Placido and Luciano?
Do you ever feel that the baritone's life is significantly different than the tenor's life?
Well, you mean personal or vocal musical?
No, vocal musical. I can guess all the ways it would be different personally. No.
It's an interesting question. I think probably it is a fact that tenors sing proportionately higher in their range than baritones and basses. They sing more high notes in a given role than baritones sing the same relative high notes. If there's a minor third difference in a baritone and a tenor, and that's an approximate fact, that means for every G a baritone has in an opera, a tenor has a B-flat. There are many more B-flats written for tenors than there are Gs for baritones. Lots of roles don't have Gs. Sometimes G-flat or F-sharp is the highest. Tenors have B-naturals and Bs and then interpolate Cs, although some of the bel canto composers wrote Cs. So they're playing their skills a little closer to their limit, which is probably one of the reasons that in history of opera, I think tenors and sopranos are, all other things being equal, are more famous than mezzos, baritones, and basses. How's that for an answer?
That's pretty good. Are there roles that you wish you could sing but you can't because it's not in your range?
Well, I suppose there are times that there's no nagging... permanent frustration about a given part that I would die to sing. But so many parts, I mean, Otello is a powerful melding of drama and words and music, voice. Anyone would, I think, love to be able to sing Otello. But, of course, Iago is not a throwaway part exactly either. And it's fun. Baritones are often... the bad guys, and of course, Otello, what I just mentioned, Iago, who's probably a psychotic bad guy, whereas Scarpia, a very different, he's a smart bad guy, violent.
bet
mean.
Bad guys are the most fun to play. Really.
Well, certainly I think it's more interesting. The part of Scarpia is more interesting as a character than the part of Cavaradossi. He's the idealist, but he usually sings of love or some kind of idealistic emotion, whereas the baritone can vacillate between, well, real love, anger, jealousy. The soprano always loves the tenor somehow, and the baritone is the toi of ménage à toi. And he always loses, or almost always.
But I'm sure that doesn't affect your personal life.
No, stage is one thing.
That's right.
Off stage is something else.
I want to ask you one more thing about your early career. I know when you were getting started, you used to record some commercials. Who did you do commercials for?
Well, you mean products?
Product commercials, yeah.
The two big Saturation Time Network products were Schlitz beer and Marlboro cigarettes. Perfect things for singers.
Which jingles were there? They've had so many.
You mean on the air I can do that?
Well, actually, you could, yeah.
You get a lot to like with a Marlboro filter, flavor pack, or box, courtesy of Scarpia. Or there's just one Schlitz, yeah, yeah, nothing else comes near. When you're out of Schlitz, you're out of beer, and so forth.
Oh, what a different
Kellogg's
voice.
Cornflakes and... Oklahoma gasoline. I think that company was bought out. But Oklahoma, I said, Oklahoma will put a tiger in your tank. Lot of stuff. That was fun. I suppose that was an outgrowth of the jazz bass playing all through high school and college and the pop stuff. I used to croon.
Yeah, well, you sure sing those commercials in a different voice than you sing your opera parts.
Well, that was one of the reasons that I was able to get in with the group. This was all in Chicago, by the way. And they found that, first, I could sight read. Second, I could use a very pop sound. I could use a medium pop sound, or I could use a very zingy, kind of barroom, unrefined sound. But you want a macho sound for some of these things, but you don't want it to sound refined. And I could change as we found the sound that seemed to say the right thing for that product. And so during the 60s, even in the early 70s, I did a lot of stuff at Universal Studios in Chicago.
Were you hedging your bets in case you never made it in opera?
No, I didn't think of it hedging. I just thought it was good hustling. Because as you know, if a product is used on network TV or radio, there can be a lot of money involved.
Right.
I mean, tens of thousands of dollars even back then. Now I guess it's even hundreds of thousands. But I missed out on the hundreds of thousands. But.
Baritone Cheryl Milnes is my guest. There was a hiatus in your career a few years ago when you ruptured a capillary in your throat, and that went undiagnosed for a while. And I think for a while you were quite afraid that about what was happening to your voice.
I suppose panic would be a better word.
Did that make you think about what you'd want to do when you retire from singing?
Yes, although, I mean, certainly it focused in various thoughts, although I think I've been singing 22 years at the Met, 27 years in a career. I think after the first 10, 15 years of a career, one does start to look down the road, because the older singers at the Met, when I first went there, you start to see them retiring out slowly and doing other things or not doing other things. And because I have always enjoyed teaching, I do master classes around the country and in Europe too, for that matter, have for a long time and continue to do them more and more and more. And I think that certainly is a direction that I will go. And during that time of, wasn't exactly a hiatus, but there, I canceled 3 months at the Met and certain other performances. It does, panic has a way of moving you in another direction.
Fires you up. Well, outside of family, is a throat doctor one of the people closest to any opera singer?
Well, sure, in a word, yes. Because that is such a personal relationship. I have an old Viennese doctor in New York, actually two doctors, Dr. Reckford and Dr. Gould both, which kind of combines the best of America and the best of Europe. But Dr. Reckford is 80-some years old and practiced medicine, voice in Vienna before the Second World War, and he, from his memory, you get a procession of names that he knew and whose throats he worked on. I mean, way before Corelli, Del Monaco, who were his clients, but people from the 20s and 30s, unbelievable to talk to him about voice.
I'm not sure who did the calculations, but it has been computed that you have become the most recorded opera singer ever in America. I hope this means that you enjoy recording.
Well, there's no doubt of the advantage of recording because the records can precede you and follow you and be there while you're there, and it's a little like movies where the movie star is being seen all over the world simultaneously. We're being heard all over the world simultaneously. Actually, I find recording difficult, though, to get in the sound some kind of the visual energy that one sees in a performance, or hopefully sees in a performance, to get that on the sound alone. That is a big challenge. Also, to do it in a studio, which is more sterile by its nature. You don't have an audience to react to and with. I find recording difficult. I seem to pour out more in order to get it all in the sound than perhaps on stage when the eye and the ear are working together.
Well, I enjoy your recordings, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us today about your life.
Been a pleasure.
Operatic baritone Cheryl Milnes can be seen on the PBS program Richard Tucker, The American Caruso, which will be shown on many public TV stations this Friday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with one of Africa's most acclaimed novelists, Chinua Achebe. I hope you can join us. Here's Cheryl Milnes singing the role of Iago from Otello. Otello is sung by Placido Domingo.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Stephen Sondheim composes at the piano. For most of Sondheim's shows, it was Jonathan Tunick who took the piano score and expanded it into an orchestral score. Coming up, Tunick discusses the art of orchestration. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue of recordings by tenor saxophonist Don Byas. Kevin calls his style about the prettiest you'll ever hear. And television critic David Bianculli previews the trial of Bernard Goetz. The reenactment of the so-called subway vigilante trial airs this week on public television's American Playhouse. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. The banks were offering expanded services today in Panama, in some cases for the first time in 2 months. Some banks reported long lines, but they were not mobbed. One government official called it a smooth reopening and said it is a step towards the normalization of the economy. Banks closed on March 4th after a flood of withdrawals and a U.S. cash crisis aimed at ousting military leader Manuel Noriega. The closure of the banks touched off widespread unrest. A spokesman for Republican presidential candidate George Bush said today the vice president was aware of drug trafficking charges against Noriega well before the general's indictment earlier this year. But Peter Thiele said Bush viewed the information as speculative. The question of exactly when Bush learned of Noriega's alleged role in drug dealing has become an important issue in his campaign. The White House today denounced the most recent kiss-and-tell book by an administration insider, this one by former White House Chief of Staff Donald Regan. In it, Regan details Nancy Reagan's veto over planned presidential speeches and news conferences based on the advice of her astrologer. NPR's Jim Angle has the story.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the Regan book is like all kiss-and-tell books, which he said seek to exploit the first family for personal self-interest. He said the president feels deep personal disappointment with this breach of confidence. Donald Regan says the first lady's astrological concerns got out of hand during the Iran-Contra crisis, at a time when advisors were telling the president he needed to give speeches and news conferences to restore his credibility. The first lady told Regan the president couldn't give any news conferences for at least 3 months. She gave White House officials a list of prohibited dates that said late December of 1986 to March of 87 was bad for presidential activities. During a Rose Garden ceremony today, the president was asked whether he will allow astrology to continue to play a part in the makeup of his daily schedule.
I can't, because I never did.
The first lady said through a spokesman she was surprised by the vengefulness of Regan's attack. Regan says he used no adjectives or deprecating references to the first lady. He only reported what she did. I'm Jim Angle in Washington.
Despite repeated setbacks, Secretary of State George Shultz will resume his Mideast peace mission. Shultz is to begin another trip to the region immediately after the superpower summit concludes in Moscow next month. Barry Schweid reports.
Shultz will go to Israel, Jordan, Syria, and Egypt, trying to set up a Mideast peace conference and negotiations on the Palestinians and on an overall settlement. State Department spokesman Charles Redman, announcing the fourth Shultz trip to the area so far this year, said all the parties had privately urged Shultz to return. Publicly, however, there is little visible support for the Shultz plan. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir is opposed to the peace conference, and King Hussein of Jordan hasn't given any public indication he's ready to negotiate in behalf of the Palestinians. But Shultz will try from June 3rd until June 9th, when he's due to attend a NATO foreign ministers meeting in Madrid. Nobody, including the State Department, is predicting success. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
Conservative Jacques Chirac will resign as Prime Minister of France. The announcement in Paris today followed the re-election of Socialist President François Mitterrand, who won a landslide victory over the right-wing Chirac in Sunday's election. Mitterrand is expected to name Chirac's replacement within a day or two. Mitterrand is the first French president to win a second 7-year term in a popular election. Police in Moscow today arrested 5 people near the planned meeting site of a new opposition party in the Soviet Union. The police prevented the meeting of the Democratic Union. The new party seeks a parliamentary democracy, a new constitution, and the withdrawal of Soviet troops from Eastern Europe. 14 of the 60 party members arrested yesterday remained in jail today. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In jazz, the tenor saxophone is traditionally a great instrument for playing ballads. And of all the tenor saxophonists, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says the late Don Byas was one of the most soulful. Byas lived in Europe from the mid-40s till his death in 1972. Kevin has a review of a new reissue of some recordings Byas made for the French Blue Star label shortly after his move to that country.
Greatness rewarded to jazz musicians on a point system, the great Don Byas would have been an also-ran. He had no original conception, frankly modeling his style on that of Coleman Hawkins. He had no desire to dig up odd material, being content to play venerable old tunes. Nor was he ever a focus of controversy. All he did right, I'm afraid, was play the tenor saxophone in about as pretty a style as anyone who ever picked up the horn. A new reissue, Don Byas on Blue Star, a compact disc on MRC, is prime Byas. It was recorded in Paris for Blue Star Records between 1947 and 1952. It's mostly devoted to standard ballads, usually played by quartet with Art Simmons on piano, although pianist Billy Taylor, trumpeter Peanuts Holland, and trombonist Tyree Glenn are featured on the 1947 dates. On the later tracks, Byas hogs the solo room, but no one's complained yet. Listen to him on the French ballad En ce temps-là from 1952. Like Coleman Hawkins and another of his great disciples, Ike Quebec, Byas had hung out with the early boppers and had checked out their music without coming under their sway. Byas claimed he contributed more to bop than anyone but its innovators knew. Playing with the boppers did enrich his harmonic sense, and he would play a few of their tunes, but his rhythmic orientation and robust sound remained rooted in Hawkins. Here's Don Byas in 1947 on Charlie Parker's Billy's Bounce. On these 23 selections, Byas doesn't play with as much flash as he did in the mid-40s, but his tone had deepened by the early 50s. Like other graduates of the Hawkins School, he'd been profoundly affected by Ben Webster's breathy variations on Hawkins' style. By the 60s, Byas's tone became more raucous, a shame, though you can understand why he felt compelled to change. By 1952, he'd been typecast as a balladeer, and his playing had become mannered. The last five tunes here start with the same mooing slur, and four of them move at the same slow pace. Still, these sides catch Bias the ballad player at his peak. His sound was never more touching or luminous. Don Bias on Blue Star is almost all a CD reissue should be. There's no fad in this 70-minute program. Just a ton of romantic music played by someone whose artistry is so overwhelming, it makes you forget the reasons he shouldn't be great.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Don Bias on Blue Star, reissued on the MRC label. This is Fresh Air. When Stephen Sondheim needs someone to orchestrate a musical score, he usually turns to Jonathan Tunick. Tunick has worked on Sweeney Todd, Pacific Overtures, A Little Night Music, Follies, and the current Broadway hit Into the Woods. Stephen Holden in the New York Times described Tunick as the most sought-after orchestrator on Broadway. For Sweeney Todd, Tunick evoked the madness of obsessive revenge. And for Into the Woods, Tunick chose the instruments that put rhythm into the steps of the fairy tale characters as they began their journey.
Into the woods without delay, but careful not to lose the way. Into the woods, who knows what may be lurking on the journey. Into the woods to get the thing that makes it worth the journeying. Into the woods
to see the key,
to sell the cow,
to make the potion,
to see, to sell, to get, to bring, to make, to live, to go to the festival. Into the woods! Into the woods! Into the woods, then out of the woods! And open your door!
Is it hard to tell where composing ends and orchestrating begins?
Well, as Rimsky-Korsakov said, orchestration is composition. And it's true in the sense that orchestration is one of the composer's tools. The orchestrator's job is to take up where the composer has left off, wherever that might be, and finish the music.
Let's look at Into the Woods as an example. Did Stephen Sondheim, the composer, describe a kind of overall idea of what he wanted before he actually gave you the score?
Well, I found the best way to deal with a musical is to approach it in theatrical terms. This is true of film music, too, in dealing with film directors. It's better to stay away from technical discussions and make the discussions aesthetic ones.
So what kind of aesthetic ideas did you talk about before getting to work?
Now you're trying to pin me down. I have to confess that with the experience, all the experience that I've had doing shows, I don't talk about it that much anymore. Just give it a quick listen and have a look at it at rehearsal, and I pretty much know what to do.
There's a song in Into the Woods called Agony. Mm-hmm. And it's sung by two princes, one who's in love with Cinderella and one who's in love with Rapunzel. And it's a beautiful melody, and it's a really yearning kind of song.
They're not exactly in love with him. They just want to get them.
They want to get them, right. But in the show, it's kind of sung for laughs. It's very self-dramatizing, and the princes are doing this kind of one-upsmanship about who's really in more agony over their woman. Now, you have a kind of nice string quartet chamber kind of sound behind it. Can you talk about why you chose those instruments and why you chose that kind of setting for this song?
So how can I answer this question? As you were asking me the question, I was thinking of the two princes up on the stage and how it reminds me of vaudeville and it's like two Jewish comics doing a one-upsmanship routine, or Abbott and Costello. It's a comedy song. And one of the reasons it's funny is it's couched in these melodramatic or super romantic terms. That's one of the reasons it's funny. It goes against type.
Exactly. And then behind it, you have this very refined chamber-like music for something that you've described as reminding you of a vaudeville scene. I mean, I love that kind of contrast. I think it really works.
Well, it's the exact opposite of what the meat of the number is.
High in her tower, she sits by the hour, maintaining her hair. Blithe and becoming, and frequently humming a light-hearted air. If there only were doors. Agony, all the torture they teach. What's as intriguing or half so fatiguing as what's out of reach? Am I not sensitive?
You've had a long collaboration with Stephen Sondheim. How did you first start working together?
Well, it's not a collaboration. It's really an employment.
Uh-huh. That's an interesting distinction,
A collaboration is... Rodgers and Hammerstein is a collaboration. They ran a business together, and they split the money.
Right.
That's a collaboration.
So you're a kind of gun for hire, the way you see it, when you're an orchestrator.
I like to think of it as a profession, that a composer would hire an orchestrator, and the way you would hire a dentist, or... You know, you hire a dentist to fix your teeth because he knows something that you don't know. As a matter of fact, I've veered away from orchestrating for other people. I've done very little of it, actually, in the last 10 years. In a way, I've felt I had said pretty much all I had to say as a Broadway orchestrator. And I enjoy writing film music and television music.
Do you think you've, in a way, though, become better known for your orchestrations than for
obviously,
your compositions?
Obviously, that's what people want to interview me about. So,
and it drives you crazy, right?
Well, it's okay. Actually, I've had a wonderful time working on Broadway. It's great. You know, you put your name on a poster and you go and hang around backstage and you're in show business, and it's exciting.
Now, I'm going to confess that I really am more familiar with you as an orchestrator than as a composer. So perhaps you can fill me in on some of the scores that you've composed.
I've done a great deal of work for PBS. Any number of television films. I was the composer on Columbo. That was my first job as a composer.
Oh, really?
And I've just finished the pilot for a new series called Tattingers that's going to be on NBC.
When you are composing, do you do your own orchestration or do you ship that out to somebody else?
Well, it's an intriguing question. I have when time demanded called in help and orchestration, this last project I orchestrated myself. You see, my whole approach to music is not to think of orchestration as a process that happens to music after it's written.
You hear the whole thing in your mind with the different instruments.
Now, I understand that most composers don't think that way. They seem to write their music for the piano and then subject it to this process called orchestration, whereby it's changed from one thing into another. I don't write music that way. As a matter of fact, when I write something and I have to play it for somebody on the piano, I have to then go over to the piano and learn how to play it and practice it, which I find an agonizing ordeal because, in my conception, it already exists. It exists on paper, and it's already pretty much in its completely developed form. Now I have to change it into piano music and worse, learn to play it, and I don't play that well.
There's a new album of Cleo Lane singing Stephen Sondheim songs, and you orchestrated that record for her.
Well, the other thing I always wanted to be was an arranger like Nelson Riddle. You know, see, these are the things I wanted to be when I was a kid. I wanted to be a band leader like Stan Kenton and have an enormous jazz band and stand in front of it and lead it and write for it. I wanted to be a studio arranger conductor like Nelson Riddle or Robert Farnon. See, I was born too late for all these things. And I wanted to be a wonderful movie composer like Max Steiner.
Uh-huh. So this is your Nelson Riddle homage.
Yes.
The sun comes up. I think about you. The coffee cup. I think. I want you so, it's like I'm losing my mind. The morning ends, I think about you. I talk to friends, I think about you.
Cleo Lane singing Losing My Mind from the new album Cleo Sings Sondheim, orchestrated and conducted by Jonathan Tunick. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with NPR's Daniel Zwerdling and see what they have planned. Hi, Danny.
Hey, Terry.
I understand you're doing a whole extended report on AIDS. What exactly are you looking
at? An extraordinary report on AIDS and how it's affected the gay community in San Francisco. Specifically, that city, of course, has long been considered the worldwide mecca for gay men and women. And we're going to examine how AIDS has not only wreaked havoc on the gay community, killing many of its members, but how it has helped bring people together.
What other stories are you following?
Well, the latest charges about the Reagan White House from former Chief of Staff Don Regan. And, you know, we're talking to some of Reagan's supporters who say none of these charges affect them at all. They still think the president has done a great job.
Okay, well, thanks. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week, Public Television's American Playhouse is presenting a 2.5-hour drama based on the confession and subsequent trial of New York subway gunman Bernard Goetz. Television critic David Bianculli has a review.
Judge Crane, members of the bar, Bernard Goetz, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. As you know by now, my name is Barry Slotnick, and I represent Bernard Goetz. I've just sat and listened to the district attorney's summation, which might indicate that Bernard Goetz was a citizen Rambo. During the course of the summation, I scratched my head and I wished they had a tape recorder.
Who needs a tape recorder when you've got primetime television? This week on PBS, American Playhouse takes edited transcripts of the Goetz trial and dramatizes them using actors, like the one you just heard, to recreate the most important portions of the famous subway vigilante case. It seems fitting, since this show is all about the law, to point out that a televised version of a true life trial is not without precedent. The most obvious parallel occurred back in 1981, when NBC presented People versus Jean Harris just 9 weeks after she was convicted of murdering the Scarsdale diet doctor. And less directly, think of all the great TV drama that has been based, at least in part, on court transcripts. Fatal Vision, Echoes in the Darkness, Helter Skelter, The Chicago 8 Conspiracy Trial, and dozens of others. What makes these shows so fascinating when they're done well is that they're so incredible, they're credible. What I mean is, no writers would ever make characters say or do some of the things that real people say or do in the courtroom or while giving private testimony. The speeches run on too long, direct questions elicit very oddball answers. And, unlike Perry Mason, things aren't always wrapped up neatly or sparked by a surprise witness. So if the actors and the directors can create and sustain the true atmosphere of the trial, what happens is that you forget you're watching a dramatization. That's what happens in this American Playhouse production, which is why it's so intriguing. The trial of Bernard Goetz, the TV trial, that is, was produced by James Fraidberg, producer of Broadway's Burn This, and adapted, directed, and co-produced by Harry Moses, who's fresh from 14 years with CBS News, where he produced reports by Bill Moyers and Mike Wallace. Maybe it's too easy to presume that Fraidberg focused on the drama and Moses focused on the facts, but however they collaborated, the results are very exciting. One of the keys, of course, is the actor portraying Goetz. He's Peter Crombie, and though he's quiet through most of the trial, he gets the drama's best scene when he reenacts Goetz's videotape confession. Explaining how and why he shot four black youths on a subway car, Crombie's Goetz doesn't sound like Rambo. The way he talks, he's more like Ramble-O.
I was in fear, and that's good, because that helps you think. But when I saw his eyes, up to that point, my state of mind changed, and you go into a different state of mind where reality totally changes. So I had my pattern of fire laid out, and it was obvious, and what you do is you don't think. You don't think. You act. Speed is everything. Speed is everything. You just think of speed and the count. He gave me verification when he said, give me $5. I pulled out the piece. I just started firing.
Richard Libertini, as Goetz's lawyer, is the only recognizable face in the crowd. Otherwise, the trial is recreated by a cast of unfamiliar but talented actors, including Andrew Robinson, Larry B. Scott, and Dan Florek. The verdict on PBS's The Trial of Bernard Goetz is a favorable one. The producers in this case are not guilty of anything, except of producing a fine and fair docudrama about a controversial trial.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll speak with novelist Elizabeth Benedict. Her second novel, A Beginner's Book of Dreams, is a coming-of-age story about a girl whose parents act like children. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will look back at the brief regional revival of a cappella singing in the mid-60s that included groups like the Five Fashions and the Q-Tones. And book critic John Leonard will review The New Confessions, a new novel by the British writer William Boyd. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.